Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, back to the NIDS View, a weekly podcast by the NIDS Podcasting Network. I'm Jim Petrosky, president and co-founder of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, and welcome to our show today. We're going to take a little bit of a different stance today because, one, Curtis is still out screwing off. Adam's still wherever Adam went to, and they left the shop to me, and I get to call the show. So with me today is a good friend and a colleague, Shimon Holston. He's a scientist, and he's worked at many different places, and we have him give an introduction to what he did and how he got where he is. But we want to talk a little bit today about careers in deterrence, transitioning from the military to civilian world, and applying yourself to what really matters, which is national deterrence and deterrence as a career field, not just as an idea. And so, Shimon, I'm going to turn it over to you to say welcome to you. Tell everybody a little bit about yourself in case they don't know you, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Petrosky. I really appreciate the intro. I'll start at the beginning. So I am retired now, Army Lieutenant Colonel, retired on September 30th. So I entered the Army as a Army chemical officer. You know, the focus was on CBRN, passive defense.
What's CBRN there, Shimon?
CBRN is chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear. So the Army has a core of officers that deal with, how do we defend our soldiers when they're fighting from chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear contamination, so that those soldiers can continue to fight. The Army Chemical Corps was founded in World War I after the gas attacks. And so that's what I originally entered into the Army as. And I did that for approximately 10 years. Started off as a battalion chemical officer, so I would advise the battalion leadership on, you know, making sure the soldiers were properly trained and equipped, working with the chemical NCOs to ensure that the battalion was basically ready to fight in a through a CBRN environment.
Very difficult problem, by the way, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, it's very difficult because one of the issues that makes it challenging is, we haven't actually had a chemical warfare. We haven't been attacked with biological weapons in a very long time. And so, I discovered when I started in this field that there was a lack of motivation to train and have to go to the, they call it the gas chamber. You train on a riot control agent that's a simulant to a chemical attack. You're supposed to go into the field. You have to put on this hot mop gear for a field training exercise. So there's just people didn't like doing it. It's not fun. And so that was a very challenging just to get people trained on those types of things early on in my career. But that's what I started off with. I was in that environment for about 10 years. And then in 2012, I switched over to the Army's officer corps. It's called Nuclear Encounter Proliferation Officers. So I switched over to that, and then I started immediately working on a PhD in nuclear engineering because that career field really likes their officers to have backgrounds, whenever possible, in nuclear policy or technical backgrounds in nuclear engineering. And I went to the Air Force Institute of Technology, which is where I originally met you, Dr. Petrosky. So I finished that up, and then when I graduated from AFIT, the Air Force Institute of Technology, I went to my first Army nuclear officer job. The Army has a agency on Fort Belvoir, Virginia, called the U.S. Army Nuclear Encountering WMD Agency, and that agency is focused on weapons of mass destruction, but a specific focus on nuclear and how does the Army not only, so the let me back up a little bit. So the Chemical Corps job is to make sure that soldiers can continue to fight through a nuclear environment, through fallout, radiation, and those types of things. The USANCA and the 52s, they deal with nuclear weapons effects. So, for example, you know, if a nuclear weapon goes off, you know, obviously, you know, there's going to be blast. There's going to be thermal radiation, fires, buildings blown down. Well, what the Chemical Corps doesn't teach their officers is, you know, can tanks or light infantry, will they be able to move through this terrain after a nuclear weapon has gone off? What is the state of that terrain in terms of the scheme of maneuver for the ground elements? So that is what the Army's nuclear officers do. That is what USANCA focuses on. And so that is where my first job as a nuclear officer was at that agency on Fort Belvoir, Virginia. My specific focus was on nuclear survivability. So if a weapon goes off and you have all of the effects from a nuclear weapon, will the Army's equipment, with their tanks, you know, Humvees, those types of things, what will the effects of the nuclear weapon do to that Army equipment? Will the Army equipment still continue to function after an electromagnetic pulse has hit them? So that was my focus when I was at USANCA, was on nuclear survivability. How do we ensure that the Army's equipment, that it's fielding, you know, when it gets new equipment, there's a whole acquisition process. And in the acquisition process, you want to ensure that the principles of nuclear survivability are adopted as they are, you know, working towards a new vehicle or a new weapon system or something like that.
Sean, yes. before we move on, because I do want you to talk about your next assignment, because it's really important, but I just want to highlight, you mentioned FA-52. That's those counterproliferation, nuclear counterproliferation officers in the Army, of yes. which I was also a member. And they are the nuclear experts among the Army for survivability. But it's, correct. You know, you brought out something that's very interesting. I think our audience would be keen to understand, is that it's almost seamless to go from chemical officer to nuclear officer, in that there are a lot of things that are related. You know, the chemistry of radioisotopes, they're obviously a chemical as well as, you know, a chemical hazard as well as a nuclear hazard. And the other piece that you brought up, and I think is sort of an interesting piece I'd like you maybe to highlight, is that, you know, we haven't had, the U.S. has not been in a chemical war since World War II. And, you know, since World War II, we've applied nuclear. They seem to be the same, but nuclear is always treated different. How did you, you know, talk a little bit about that changeover and, you know, maybe your ideas of why nuclear is so special compared to chemical or biological, even though we lump them together.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think when you look at nuclear, I mean, obviously, the destructive effects of nuclear weapons is just on a totally different scale than the effects of chemical weapons, right? So if you go back to World War One and the gas attacks, I mean, those were killing you know hundreds of people, you know, compared to one nuclear weapon could potentially kill, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. So I think mm-hmm. that's a big part of it. It's just that the effects from a nuclear weapon versus a chemical weapon are orders of magnitude different. And so I think that then causes, you know, the way we treat them just differently. That's my thoughts are about that. But yeah, as far as the transition, you're absolutely right. At the time I switched over to the FA-52, the nuclear officers, they said that approximately a third of the officers that switched over to that field came from the Chemical Corps. And I think it was a third were from engineers, and then a third were from field artillery. I'm not sure what the statistics are right now.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, because I actually started out in the field artillery as enlisted, and then I joined active duty Army as an engineer and seamlessly moved into nuclear for the same reasons. But you get that multidisciplinary favor, sort of the CBRNE, the chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and high explosive, CBRNE. Yeah, I got it right. Yep. You get that CBRNE flavor from those three, branches of yes. the Army. And I think that really brings about the nuclear expertise. highlighting for our audience how multidisciplinary this nuclear subject can be. All right, I interrupted you, by the way.
No, you're
I just
fine.
Want to let our audience know. Oh, thank you very much. You know, Shimon is such a polite guy. He keeps referring to me as Dr. Pedraskis. Once you're a faculty member and you have a student that traverses your classes, you tend to always carry that. But I just want to highlight that this is Dr. Holston who we're talking to as well. So, yeah, because the expertise in the Army needs that kind of professional, advanced education to understand these processes. Go on, Shimon, because I like the moving on to your next assignment.
Okay. Yes. All right. So I was at the U.S. Army Nuclear and Counter-UAS Agency. That was my first assignment as an Army nuclear officer. My second assignment was at the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. And at that assignment, I worked in their research and development directorate. And DITRA goes through a lot of changes in names and things like that. I think that the joke for the acronym for DTRA was, did they reorg again? So, you know, forgive me if, I don't know if some of these directors and things, their names have changed. But though I was in the research and development directorate, and then I was in their counter WMD technologies department. And that was a very, secret squirrel, so I can't get too much into it, but I was basically a program manager, you know, focused on, like, how do we stop the adversaries from obtaining weapons of mass destruction? Are there ways to do that? And so that's kind of what we investigated. And DITRA has the most, I believe, of any single agency. They have the most Army 52 officers, if I'm not mistaken, both in Fort Belvoir, and then just in and around the country and remote locations.
Do you know about how many people that is, by the way? How many there are? I remember like 57 or 60 back in the day when I was there.
Yes. When I was there, that's the number that was in my head was around 70 or something. Again, you'd have to ask the people at USANCA. They could tell you right away. But it was somewhere around 50 to 70 at the time I worked there. That Army officers that were working for in DITRA in various different capacities. They have our, not only is DITRA headquartered at Belvoir, and they have officers there, but then they have elements that are at Kirtland Air Force Base. And so there were officers there and you know, in various different places.
When you were there, Shimon, I'm curious, because my first experience at DITRA was, you know, maybe very similar to yours. I've been in operational units. I always joked with people, my first time I ever went, quote, TDY without a backpack and a Humvee was, well, actually in grad school, I went down to Bethpage to do some research. And then, you know, later on when I got to DITRA, I finally started going TDY and you hang out in a hotel, which is like completely, like, you get paid to stay in a hotel. Wow, this is pretty cool. It's usually a tent and you're fed MREs once or twice a day. So, you know, it's sort of a real transition. But when you got to DITRA, I'm curious, what was the transition like in terms of working with industries and academics? I mean, you did a lot of that, didn't you, in terms of, you know, without talking about the SQL Squirrel pieces, but what's that like? I mean, you really get a feel for what's going on, don't you?
Yes. So, DITRA, you definitely do. When I was there, I definitely worked with the interagency a lot. Other three-letter agencies. So that was a very good educational experience. And then I worked with industry mostly in terms of the contractors we were using. We were using, I'm hesitant to say, but we were using some very good contracting agencies that are organizations that were very good at their job, very good engineers and scientists that worked for those companies. And so I got a lot of interaction on that side with the private sector and just saw a lot of their capabilities and like how we could bring those in and utilize them, in the work that we were doing at DTRA. And I got a bit of that interaction when I was at USANCA as well, working with the interagency and my next assignment was at the NNSA, but even before then, I got to work with at DITRA and at USANCA, had interactions with the national labs as well.
Yeah, that's a great experience. And for people who are looking at a career in which I don't think you do anything twice in 1 year, you know, from 1 year to the next.
Yes.
You know, you're moved from the military side to sort of an academic side, and you did a great job at AFIT in completing your PhD, and congratulations again and again and again. You know, AFIT's a hard, hard program for those who want to go through it. But if you want a good education, you get a hard education, right? That's the way it goes. But you know, transitioning there, and then suddenly your eyes are open to all these other things. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, I want to second what you said about AFIT. It's a good program, but it's a hard program. You know, a lot of Army officers, you know, we go to what they call courses and things, and they're like multiple choice questions and things like that. And like, no, AFIT is a real hard school, a real hard college, on par with, you know, any other college. And that PhD program was difficult. The nuclear engineering program was difficult. But it's a good program. You get a quality education. And I would encourage anyone that's eligible to attend to think about it.
Yeah, very good. So tell me about your time at NNSA there, Shimon, because that was the last piece. Then we'll get on to moving to real important things like why you joined NIDS.
Yes. Yeah, so after I left the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, then my next assignment was at the National Nuclear Security Administration. So NNSA has about approximately 10 Army officers there. Then obviously it also has, you know, Air Force officers and Navy officers there, but approximately 10 Army officers. As far as I know, the Army nuclear officers are there. And so my first assignment there was in the Office of Engineering and Technology Maturation. They call it NA115. And then so that office, their primary job is that, you know, a lot of our, or all of our nuclear weapons, you know, they've been fielded decades ago. And, you know, if you want to, so it's, let's say, for example, there's some a material or something that needs to go in the weapon, and the manufacturer no longer exists, you know, so how do you replace that? Or there's, you know, there are parts that there's a part of the weapon that you want to, instead of having the 90s technology, you want to replace it with modern technology, but it continued the same function, the same form and fit. And so that office was focused on, you know, how do we get newer technologies, and they may do the same thing as the older technologies, but how do you get newer technologies into the stockpile? Sometimes they would offer new functionality as well, but that was a big challenge. The weapons program managers, the national lab scientists that work on weapons, you know, we've stopped doing underground nuclear testing in 1992, and so how do we validate that a new piece of technology that we insert into the stockpile is going to work? And so, you know, you have to do modeling and simulation. There is some subcritical experiments below the level of critical. You can do tests like that. But at the end of the day, you can't do an actual nuclear test. You can't put that piece into an actual underground nuclear explosion, get all the data. And so there's just a tremendous lot of concern in terms of, what will this new technology, if we put it in, will it do? What will it do to the yield? What will it do to the weapon? And so there was a lot of resistance in trying to transition some of the technologies we were working on into the other parts of NNSA that were then adopted into the weapon. And I mean, there's a whole, you know, a whole kind of background argument, both depending on your point of view. But the bottom line is that when I got there, I had never heard the term psychological readiness until I arrived there. And they talked about psychological readiness. How do you get people, you can show them all of the data on some new piece of technology saying this will work, you know, we validated, et cetera, et cetera. But you still have to get over that the decision makers, their mind has to be at that level, that psychological readiness level of accepting that risk of that new technology. And we did everything we could to mitigate risk, and to do all the tests, all the experiments, et cetera, to show that the risk would be low in our opinion. But it was just very challenging to get to transition technologies because of we don't have the connection to the underground nuclear testing. And that was a very big thing, is the underground nuclear testing and the data that we had from that, and trying to connect it to newer technologies. But that was like the primary mission of that office.
Yeah, a lot of the work, and while I was at AFIT, the joy of teaching at AFIT, you still remain connected to all the operational work, and I did a lot of operational work with the national labs. And my experience in working with the national labs, and to our national lab scientist listeners, I'm going to pat you on the back, because even though I was teaching this stuff, and even though I had the challenges of learning and developing new ideas, et cetera, from a teaching standpoint, every time I ran into one of those top-notch scientists and engineers out at any of the national labs, I always was challenged because of their expertise and professionalism. But you know what I found interesting, and I may have a different take. I know you had the, what'd you call it, psychological
readiness level.
So psychological readiness level. I'll be honest with you, I've never heard that before. But you know, what I'm hearing is, though, from a scientific standpoint, it is very difficult to convince someone who has not gone through the problem, the experimentation, the solution. I mean, you think about when you were doing your PhD work and trying to describe it, not only in a, you describe it in a dissertation, but then you're asked to write a paper. So you're writing a 3-page paper about what you did for 4 years, and all mm-hmm. the details have to be there. And then imagine trying to convince somebody who's never done that scientific work to tell them how you did it. It's a real challenge, and it's a challenge for our national labs. And I think, going back to my comment about chemical and nuclear, the average citizen does not quite, it does not comprehend it. And I'm not saying people are stupid, don't get me wrong, but yeah. It took, I always tell people, I'm an EMP expert, okay? My first electromagnetic pulse class that I took at Millersville University in Pennsylvania, some small school, I'm going to tell our audience, I got a C in that class. I ended up taking it over. And it takes time to understand this stuff and work it out. And yes. It takes, it's hard work. So you talk about that. I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into that. How do you do that? Because you were a program manager, so your responsibility was to make the program work, to convince the bosses, but also to evaluate the work that was being done. How do you do that? Before we, we'll move on. But I really am curious about that piece of it, because I think that's the scientific challenge of today with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it was so it was very difficult, and I don't want to so they have the weapons program managers. I mean, they're under at NNSA. I mean, they're under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure to deliver. And they're taking a risk if they accept a new piece of technology into their weapon systems and all that. So I certainly am not in any way trying to say they don't have a difficult job. But yeah, it was just very difficult, in trying to go through this process of saying, we've developed something, and here's the data. It's went through all these different kind of working groups. They have these working groups at the national labs that are supposed to, they review all of the results, the data, make their recommendations, and then it's supposed to go on to it's handed off to like another working group. And so it was just a continuous process of going through that, having briefs, trying to explain to the leaders that we think we're ready, or we think this is good, we think this can be transitioned. And I think the biggest thing that helped was you have to get with your transition partner and try to like work with them through the whole process, from the beginning to the end. So that was something we definitely learned. When I arrived there, it was explained to me that had been a previous problem. They were fixing it when I got there, but that, you're working on some technology, you're maturing it, but you haven't really spoken with the transition partner, or they've brought in late and you haven't gotten their feedback. You haven't talked to them. And so a lot of that stuff was improving when I got there as like, strategies. How do we transition? The transition partner should be with us at the beginning. We're going to meetings with the transition partner. We're getting their feedback. So all those types of things. So, I mean, it was a continuous, just kind of a continuous battle. Some things were successful, some things, not so much. But you really just got to be engaged. I think that's probably the biggest thing, is just engagement. You got to get out there. We're inviting them to meetings, the transition partners, they're inviting us to meetings. We're just constantly trying to stay in communication with them about what was happening, on this technology that we were working on.
Yeah, and I'm certain we're probably the only people in the world with nuclear weapons that go through this inordinate, you know, process to, one, modernize our fleet with the tools that we have. And we are sure, I mean, our scientists, we use experts like yourself who have been on the operational side, who are on the employment side, who understand the difficulties here and are educated in the way that you've been educated in order to make sure that our nuclear weapons are safe and secure, and we can depend on them. And that's a big part of the deterrence aspect. So all that headache you talk about and all the stress and such that your leaders go through, and I know many of those leaders, and hopefully some of them are listening to us here. I agree with you. Their job is very difficult. It's hard to prove things, but they're proofed very, very well. And I have severe respect for the people that do that. And so, so I think that part of what you've served the nation with, thank you, by the way, and the way that we've done that is proof that our deterrents, our nuclear weapons are ready to go. They're sure and ready, and we're going to continue to modernize them and make them better using more modern equipment, et cetera, to be able to make them stronger, more robust, more reliable, and safer, of course. And hats off to them. Good. No, thank you so much. That's a good discussion there. So I want to turn, because we're going to run out of time here, because you and I could probably talk for 3 or 4 hours here, and our audience is supposed to be driving home and listening to this and enjoying it. And I don't want them to, you know, have to take a second loop around the block just to hear the last part of this podcast. But I do want to transition. So you decided to retire. And you retired this past year, and that's good. And you did a skill bridge job. We'll talk a little bit about that. So where are you heading? What do you see as the future for you?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, which I am exploring right now. I'm actually actively, you know, applying to jobs and things like that, looking for.
Don't you hear that, audience? Shaman's out there. He's out there. So that's why you're here.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I love the Army. It was a great experience. I would do it again. And my son is 16, and I'm encouraging him to think about military service. You know, at least do 3 years. You don't have to do 20. So I love it. But it was just for me personally, I felt like, you know, I had kind of done what I wanted to do in the Army. You know, when I originally joined, it was just, hey, I'm just going to do 3 years. It was 2005. The war was going on. So I'll do 3 years, you know, I'll deploy, serve my country, you know, come back, get out type of thing. And then obviously 20 years later, you know, but, so I decided to retire. My last day in the Army was September 30th. And now, you know, I've been on, I was on terminal leave, and now I'm just, you know, out, you know, and exploring career fields. I mean, you know, my wife works full time. She has a great job. So, you know, I'm not desperate or anything like that. But, I'm exploring my options. Yeah. I am applying to positions, and we'll see what happens. But I've been interested in, you know, once I became a nuclear officer, first of all, I've been interested in policy going back to my beginning in the Army. You know, as I was in the Army, I was kind of, you know, on the receiving end, if you will, of policy. I saw policy in action. I was deployed to Iraq in 2007, and I was there when they announced, oh, we're going to have this Iraqi surge, you know, and we're going to, everybody has to stay in Iraq, and then we're bringing in more troops and all that type of stuff. You know, I was in the Army as we were going through the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So I've seen policy in the Army, you know, kind of. Been on the receiving end of policy. And then when I became an Army nuclear officer, that's when I started becoming more interested in policy in terms of nuclear deterrence, nuclear weapons, our strategy, and those types of things. As an active duty officer, I didn't have an opportunity to really be on the nuclear policy side, but I've always had an interest. And so as I'm getting out of the Army, you know, I was like, well, I would really like to be more involved on the nuclear policy side. You know, I was aware that you had founded this, I think, excellent think tank. I mean, you guys, NIDS does so much, you know, with the journal Global Security Review, the podcast, the seminars, you know, the educational outreach. So I thought that was a fantastic organization. And then at the end of the day, I fundamentally believe in NIDS, the vision, which is that, you know, a credible nuclear deterrent, you know, is the backbone of American national security. So I believe that fundamentally. And so I thought, you know, it would be a a great fit. So that's why I reached out to you and to just show my interest in this great organization.
Oh, well, thank you. No, that was a great advertisement. I won't have to put one at the end there. No, but you're exactly right. I mean, that's what we, you know, me and my co-founders, you know, it's not just me. It's a team effort, and we're you know, great gratitude to everyone that puts forth effort here. But bringing an expert like yourself as one of our fellows and giving you an opportunity to expand your career after the career, I do want to make a comment that you made, because I tend to agree, and I hear this a lot. If I had, you know, my daughter one time asked me, you know, the $1 billion lottery was out there. And she said, Dad, you ought to play that lottery. If you could have played that lottery and done it all over again, what would you do? It's like, well, I would have gone to college, gone through ROTC, joined the Army after, you know, going through. She says, that's what you did. I said, yeah, I'd do it all over again if I could start over again. There's nothing I can really regret. I loved my time in the Army. I loved the way it worked out. Becoming a nuclear officer was, being an engineer and then becoming an FA-52 and going to grad school and doing all of those things just similar to what you did. Those experiences were great. I would say you got into policy earlier because of the circumstances. I joined in 1980, and all we knew is that, you know, Reagan said we're going to take out the Russians and we're going to fight over the Fulda Gap, and that's all we fought for, you know, 15, 20 years. There was a different mindset then, but the reality is you build so much from that. And I don't know about your background as much, you know, you're growing up, et cetera, but, you know, come from a humble background and being able to do all these things all your life. I mean, what a great opportunity. And now you're out searching for positions. So maybe in our last, you know, 5 or 10 minutes here, maybe we could talk a little bit about this idea that you had originally contacted me and said, I want to get into policy. I want to be able to find a way to integrate sort of the science and technology I have into my background into policy. And then maybe tell me a little bit about maybe some advice to our listeners who maybe have children like yours who are interested in doing something and becoming, you know, becoming a part of this and finding value in national security and deterrence and find a bigger purpose in life rather than, you know, as I always tell people that are going to grad school, if you come out of grad school and you're looking for a job, you failed yourself and your school failed you. The job should be looking for you. And I truly believe that. And I've seen that happen. So maybe tell them how to maybe prepare themselves or what they should prepare for. So yeah, I know it's a lot. Go ahead.
Let me hopefully I can keep track of it. But so I definitely agree that joining the military is definitely a life path where you are serving something, you know, greater than yourself. I believe that at the time I joined, and I still believe that. When you're a young person, I think the military is just a great option. Again, just not necessarily the 20-year thing, but if you just join, you know, you have the camaraderie, you're serving your country, you'll learn some life skills, you'll learn responsibility. And, you know, as far as the junior enlisted, you have some room to make some mistakes too, and then learn from those mistakes if you have good NCOs looking out for you. And I think, you know, military service, once you finish your military service, you'll be a better person. 99% of the people anyways will be a better person than when you went in. You know, I mean, there's always some knuckleheads and all those types of things, but most people, you know, will join the military and I think they'll come out better for it. So I would definitely recommend that for any, you know, young people that maybe they're considering a career path, and even not just out of high school, but, you know, you graduate college, you can still join the military. Once you finish your bachelor's and whatnot, you can still do your service and then, you know, get out, move on with your life, you know, and you'll just have that in your background. And you can say that I served in capacity for the country. So I definitely agree with that. I'm sorry, you said a bunch of other stuff. I might have gotten lost.
It was sort of like my questions to you during your dissertation defense, right? No, the other one was, you know, what do you think would be your advice to offer to people aside from joining the military in providing that technical operational, you know, for those in the military that are maybe thinking about getting into something a little more technical, for those that maybe came out of the military and say, how can I apply that to this world? Because you've sort of done that. And I think that's a real important aspect because it's hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So if you are thinking about the technical. So, you know, I came in, I came in with a technical, background. So obviously if you kind of don't have that, technical background, it's going to be challenging, right? You may need to take some coursework or something like that, to get some of the technical background. And, you know, nowadays they have a lot of kind of online, you know, courses and classes and things like that you can take. So, yeah, so I started off, I got a physics bachelor's and, you know, physics master's and then the PhD at AFIT. I found it very useful to have that technical background, you know, in the various different positions that I had, at NNSA, at DTRA. And it wasn't necessarily required that you you don't have to have a PhD, but I did find that the technical background was very useful in understanding the challenges and thinking about the challenges. And I once had a buddy tell me that, you know, that having a physics degree, and I think you could probably apply this to just a STEM degree in general, but, you know, having a STEM background is like a Swiss Army knife, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you may have expertise in a specific subject, but it just teaches you how to think and how to problem solve. And so I found that, you know, very useful. And you need to have those skills if you're interested kind of in this, you know, in this type of environment. You know, you need to be able to think about the challenges that, you know, the country's facing, you know, in terms of the threats out there, China, Russia. You need to be able to problem solve. You have to be able to critically think. So I think if a person has those skill sets, I think they could be set up to be successful, you know, working in this environment. And just, you know, you have to have the drive to want to learn about things that maybe you don't know well. you know, you have to have that ability as well.
Thank you very much. We've come to the end of the hour. Shimon has given us a great insight into his life, but what he's done, but given maybe some ideas and cues into building a career centered around this concept of deterrence and nuclear weapons in general, and also just, you know, wrapped a flag around him because he served his country. I want to thank you for, you know, coming on the show. Thank you for your service to our country. I want to thank you for being a part of us, as Shimon said. Listen to our podcast, get the word out, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, discuss these topics. I think it's important that we have a conversation in our country about these things that are long forgotten. We've just taken our eyes off that ball, and it sort of put us in a tough position from a country standpoint. We do have our HUSI events on Fridays. Contact us at nids@thinkdeterrence.com, and we'll get you on the invite list. So to Shimon, and to our audience, and of course to our producer, Kimberly. I don't thank her enough every time, so I'm going to thank her today again for all the great work that she does putting these things together. And as always, we ask you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501(c)(3) organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
Podcasting Network.